The Bookshelf with Ryan Tuberty is brought to you by Eason, Ireland's favourite bookseller. Eason have a rich heritage of bookselling since 1886. In fact, it's probably where you got your first ever book, or maybe your last one, and hopefully your next one after you listen to this episode of our podcast. And stay listening for our Ryan Recommends slot, my weekly recommendation, where I'll discuss a book I've read recently that I think you'll really enjoy too. All the books we discuss on this episode of our podcast are available now in your local Eason store, or indeed order online from Eason's.com before 6 p.m. for same day dispatch with free delivery when you spend over a tenner. Eason, be inspired. Welcome once again to The Bookshelf with me, Ryan Tuberty, and a guest whose life story we will turn the pages over through the prism of just three books. Three books we've asked him to pluck from his very own bookshelf. These include, one, the book from the childhood, two, the book that changed your life, and three, the book that made you cry. Our guest today is one of the most successful and critically acclaimed novelists of his generation. Among his books is The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which has sold probably more than any other Irish writer since records began, at about 11 million copies. But that's just one of many, many excellent books written by the great John Boyne. Good morning, John, and nice to see you.
Good to see you.
And John, you are, when I say The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, I think, yeah, great. But when I talk to readers and other people who love your books, they always say, yes, of course that was great and it's a modern classic, but The Heart's Invisible Furies, and we could be here, The Absolutist, this is one I again adored. So are you okay with the Boy in Striped Pyjamas being constantly referred to
oh,
you?
Yeah.
Or would you prefer if at some stage people said, you know, there are...
No, I'm fine with it, because I always think, you know, you don't want to be one of those, say, singers who goes on stage and doesn't want to play their, you know, the most famous song. That was the book, you know, one of the things we're talking about today is the book that changed my life. That really was the book that changed my life in the sense of my own books. And it's the most famous one. And it really gave me the platform to write all the other books that I've written. But actually, the one I get spoken to the most about at events and festivals is Heart's Invisible Furies.
Is that right?
That's the one people seem to love the most.
Okay.
But the others, you know, Ladder to the Sky, I get a lot of that.
Love that.
All the Broken Places. So, no, I don't mind it. You know, I think it's not everybody even has one of those books that is kind of a cultural phenomenon type one, if I can say so myself.
You can say so yourself.
This is
the beauty of a podcast. You can say anything you want.
Great.
And you don't have to worry about any little mean or nasty comments coming in here, because it's
That's
a
true.
Global event.
Yeah.
So he says with no humility whatsoever. Either.
Yeah. So like I'm not everybody has one. You know, there's things like The Curious Incident. There's Normal People. You know, there's a small group of books that really... The whole planet kind of reads at the same time. And I'm lucky enough to have one of those. And if, you know, when I get to 100, if I'm, you know, pass away peacefully in my sleep, it'll probably be author of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas died today. And that's fine.
No bad thing at all.
No. But I mean, I have written, I think, much better books since. And I always want to write better books. You know, that's my aim every time.
The first book from the bookshelf you've chosen is from your childhood, and you feature here a little bit yourself in this one.
So let's go here.
Yeah,
so in this edition, so it's The Adventures of Robin Hood by Roger Lancelin Green.
Never read any of them.
No?
So you're coming to me cold here.
Okay, now this is one that I must have read 10, 15 times when I was
Robin
a kid.
Hood? Where did this come
I just
from?
Loved it. I loved Robin Hood. I loved the whole idea. I loved the adventures. I loved the, you know, robbing from the rich and giving to the poor and so on, and the... It's great stories. And Roger Lancelin Green was this fantastic storyteller for children who took a lot of things like the Greek myths and the stories of ancient Egypt, Robin Hood, and made them accessible to kids. He was friends with C.S. Lewis, with J.R.R. Tolkien. They were part of a group called the Inklings.
Oxford, where they went for pints and talked about what a great group. I didn't know he was part of that set.
He was part of that. But his speciality really was going back to kind of myths and historical things and finding a way to rewrite them for kids. And I just loved, I loved this whole story of Robin Hood. But one of the, as well as rereading it many, many times when I was a kid, it was probably my first act of writing in some way. Because when I was about 10 or 11, for the end of the year in school, we had to put on a play.
Mm.
And I decided I was going to write this play. And I was going to adapt
Robin Hood.
Robin Hood into a play.
I mean, as a fully fledged nerd myself, I think I might have been surpassed here with that one sentence alone. It's quite remarkable.
Oh, no, it gets worse. It gets worse. Trust me. It gets worse. So there was a typewriter in the house. My dad had a typewriter. So I sat down and I typed up this whole play. And I think it was about, like, it was a good 20 pages long.
Remind us of what age you were?
About 10.
Oh, for God's sake.
And it was about a good 20 pages long, which is, you know, in screen times now, that's 20 minutes.
Okay.
Right? So, and I think I had it all sort of, you know, enter Robin Hood and, you know,
exit
Maid Marian and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah.
But then my dad, I wrote the whole thing. I wrote this 20 pages, which is not for a 10-year-old. And then I gave it to my dad. He brought it into work. He photocopied it for, I guess, 30 kids in the class. He brought it home. I stapled it all up. And then I signed them all.
Did you really?
Honestly, God, I remember this distinctly.
I mean, the absolute...
The arrogance.
I was going to say confidence, but one man's confidence is another man's arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, it's embarrassing.
Did you dedicate them by name, or was it just John Boyne?
I didn't dedicate them. I think I just signed them all.
A flourish, a 10-year-old flourish.
It was a real flourish. I can remember doing it. And I remember, because I think I remember one of my friends in school saying his mother said to him something along the lines of, you know, what a piece
of work.
Yeah. You know,
sorry, we're a podcast, I can say that. We can say that now. Yeah, yeah, great.
But I guess it shows I wanted to write.
It's, yeah.
Anyway, so I distributed these 30 signs. You know, if they're out there somewhere, you know, in somebody's, you know, attic,
yeah,
you know, maybe they'd be worth something now.
Yeah, I'd like to see it.
And we put the play on. And also what I remember is that when we were rehearsing the play, I'm saying these terrible things about myself here, but when we were rehearsing the play, right, so everybody was up on the stage and I was, because I was also directing it.
Of course.
I had to do it all. And so I put the seat down in front of the stage, but of course I turned the seat around. So that, you know, I was sitting, you know, the way that somebody would.
Yeah, oh, that's great.
I thought this is the way you're supposed to do it. Yeah. Which is silly, because actually I wanted to be on the stage. I think I was the narrator. I think I wasn't the actor.
You wanted directing, narrating, author.
I was sort of like, I wanted to be a sort of a Kenneth Branagh type, you know, before Kenneth Branagh was around.
So if it was the nativity, you'd be playing Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
And the wise men and the, you know, the star, everything. So I think I was up on the stage then, I would sort of introduce it and say, you know, a long, long time ago in Sherwood Forest, there was this guy. And anyway, and then somebody would come in as Robin
Hood. And on it went.
So anyway, so I did all of that. But then years later, when I was a writer, a published writer and all that, Puffin Classics, which is the children's imprint of Penguin, they regularly reprint, you know, children's classics and find new ways to produce them for young people. But one thing they also do is ask people to write introductions for them. And I'd written a couple of introductions. I did one for Pinocchio. I did one for Little Lord Fauntleroy. And they had sent me a list at one point saying, we're doing these sort of 20 in the next year. Is there anyone here that you'd like to do? And The Adventures of Robin Hood by Roger Lancelin Green was on it. And I was like,
wonderful.
That one. So this edition, which I am now holding up, is has the name of the author, the name of the book, but underneath introduced by John Boyne. So it takes me right back to my childhood. I'll just read you the opening paragraph.
I'd love you to.
Before I ever dreamt of writing a novel, before I even thought of writing a short story, I wrote a play. It was an adaptation of the story of Robin Hood and was heavily, very heavily influenced by the book you're holding in your hands right now, Roger Lancelin Green's classic retelling of The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Which is not, sorry, I'll finish that sentence. Classic retelling of Robin Hood, which isn't half as good as the play I wrote, distributed. Oh, isn't that lovely? And very, very clean, neat copy of the book. When I was a kid, Robin Hood was a TV show, obviously, and there was the famous Robin Hood, running through the glen. Robin Hood, you know that one?
Yeah, I remember.
With his band of men, takes from the rich, steals from the rich, gives to the poor, Robin Hood. And that was it. Right, not bad.
You're auditioning for Eurovision there.
No, that'd be a bit different. Robin Hood. I think the Robin Hood then, which of our generation we'll remember is...
Robin of Sherwood.
Robin.
The Hooded Man. Yeah, that was amazing.
And
that was scary.
That was properly creepy.
Yeah.
With Clannad doing this.
So actually, it's funny you mention that because myself and my friend Brendan, who was my best friend when I was in school, used to sit beside me in every class. We were obsessed with Robin of Sherwood. And the last episode of the first incarnation with Michael Praed,
followed by the Connery lad.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think Brendan had a video recorder. We were about 12, 13, and he had videoed this. And we wrote out the entire episode and we memorized it from start to finish, the entire episode of that. I can still remember how it starts because the what's his name? The sheriff.
Yes. The sheriff of Nottingham.
Sheriff of Nottingham, that's it. He was being shaved by somebody and then the guy cuts him by mistake and he goes, if you cut me again, I'll have your head. And we memorized the whole thing. We went into school, the two of them, and, you know, and we started, you know, just doing this all day long, every day. And it's no wonder that everybody thought we were idiots.
But you would be kind of reenacting the episode of...
Yeah, we had it the whole 60 minutes. We memorized the entire thing.
Were they lonely years? As it is? I mean, that's self-isolation really right there. Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you were a teenager...
I thought it was really cool.
No, I mean, that's... Yeah. And it is...
I think maybe some of our classmates did think that there was something wrong with us, but we thought we were great.
And when you moved into your teens, how was your reading? Did you get all serious and sort of George Orwell and Clockwork Orangey? And did you
not quite for a bit? The first kind of starting point into adult literature was really kind of classics like Dickens. I got very into things like David Copperfield, anything with orphans. And you know from reading a lot of my books, I write a lot about orphans. Not orphans, I tend to get rid of the parents very, very quickly, or they're very away. Even in striped pajamas, the parents are, you know, Bruno's on his own all the time. I loved books about orphans, and I loved books about boarding schools, which is strange because, you know, my parents are great parents. But I was just obsessed with orphans and boarding schools.
Is that Dickens then?
I loved Dickens and anything like that. And so Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, Great Expectations, David Copperfield, things like that. I got very into those big books. Do you remember those, the Marshall Cavendish collection?
Yes, right? Yes.
So my dad started collecting those when I was about maybe 13, 14. And I remember the first one, I think, was Great Expectations. And then it was Jane Eyre, Far From the Madding Crowd, David Copperfield, things like that. And they were such beautiful books, beautiful hardbacks. And so I started reading them because, again, I loved the physical product of it. Yeah. And I thought, if I'm going to read this book, I want to read it in this beautiful edition.
Yeah.
So I didn't really get into contemporary fiction until I was maybe about 17, but I got into classic fiction at the range of around 13, 14 and worked my way through a lot of those.
This isn't the show we talk about anything deeply unpleasant, but you had a tough time at school and people can read around that if they choose to, but I don't really want to go there today if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Because we've spoken about that on different programs, but what I wanted to ask you was about reading as a source of comfort and refuge and escape. Yeah. Did you find books helped or could you not read? Because, you know, life was challenging.
Books were very, very important to me. I was one of those kids in school, I'd say, who it wasn't super popular, but wasn't super unpopular. Okay. I was very sort of in the middle. Yeah. You know, I had friends, but, you know, I wasn't kind of going out every weekend, getting up to all sorts. You know, I was just kind of your very steady character. But reading and writing at the time, because again, I was already writing in my teens, was my refuge. You know, I'd go home and I was more into that than I was into television, I would say. I loved reading. And, I don't think, whatever about the school stuff, I think reading wasn't to escape from any of that. It was just, it was part of who I was. Yeah. It was, you know,
it was
part of my brain. Yeah. And it's what I wanted to do.
Let's talk a little bit about book number two today on the bookshelf. John Boyne being our guest today. If you're halfway through the podcast wondering, why is he talking to this man? And John is somebody I've known for many years, largely through programs like that I've presented, be it on radio or TV. But it's always great to see you and to talk to you. And, you know, before we get on to the life-changing book, You look like somebody whose life has changed a lot. I met you today for the first time in a long time. And I never know if it's rude or if it's acceptable or if it's flattering to say to somebody, you've lost a lot of weight. You have. And then I think, well, that's none of your business. And yet we got into a conversation off air about that. Did something trigger that decision to change your lifestyle, or did you always want to do that, or what happened? Because it's quite dramatic.
Yeah, no, I went from, at my peak, I guess I was 91 kilos, and I'm now 68 kilos. Mm. So I lost about a third, really. And I did it really over the last 2 years. I would say that, we've talked before that, you know, 7 years ago, I had a sort of trauma in my life where, you know, a long-term relationship came to an end and I was very upset. And it took a long time for me to recover from it.
Because it was quite public. I mean, it became very public. And I remember talking to you at that time, and I know what trauma looks like, and you know what trauma looks like. And you're not quite yourself, are you, in the middle of a trauma?
No, and maybe at the time, speaking about it publicly, maybe it wasn't the right thing to do, but it was the way of getting it off my chest, you know. And again, because I'm a writer, I feel quite open about things. I want to get my emotions out there. But, you know, 5 years down the line, I was still really, really struggling. I was still in a bad place. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I was, you know, eating too much, drinking too much, taking too much medication, not looking after myself, not being healthy. And I got to a particular night where basically I ended up in hospital and, you know, things were not.
We can extrapolate from what you're saying is that you were thinking about maybe ending your own life at some point.
And I took more pills than
I should
have.
You gave it a go.
I gave it a go. Okay. And ended up in hospital, and I came out of that, and I just realized, like, you know, I'm too young. You know, I still have hopefully 50 years in front of me, and I don't want to be miserable all the time. I have a wonderful life. I've got a wonderful career. I've got a family who love me. I've got friends who love me and who I love back. And I just decided I had to make some change. And the first change, the change I knew that I had to make was my mental health. Not weight, it was my mental health. But the way I felt to get better mental health was to be more physically healthy. And I thought, if I can do that, if I can feel better about myself, about how I look, because I never felt confident about how I looked. You know, I always felt unhappy with that. And I thought, if I can feel confident in that, that will help. So I just started changing everything. I changed what I eat, all my diet. I incorporated exercise into my every single day. Try to walk 15 to 20,000 steps every day. Cut out all sugars, all processed foods. I kept one thing in my life, which was I love a beer. You know, when I go out with my friends, I have to have a beer. I like a beer. And I didn't want to cut out everything. You've got to have something in life.
It can't be a joyless existence, John.
Exactly.
I mean, you can't, and you can't drink books. You know what I mean? You can eat them, but you can't.
But what I can do is I can decide that at lunchtime every day, I'm not going to sit down and eat, you know, a big takeaway, a big packet of crisps, a family-sized packet of Maltesers.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to eat something healthy.
Yeah, even though you're making me hungry, talk about that. and because they are such good things.
Oh, yeah. So, and they, you know, you get addicted to them. But
what's your go-to snack now? Where you go, I really want a snack. Do you say, I'm not snacking at all? Or do you say, I'll have a bag of nuts or fruit?
Fruit, yeah. Okay. No, I got into, I find the fruit that I like. I like bananas, I like apples. You know, I don't like, say, peaches or plums. I don't bother. You know, I eat the things I want to eat. And look, I won't lie, you know, once in a blue moon, maybe I have a Snickers or something, then I just need, you get a sugar rush and you say, I have to have something.
I'm so disappointed in your gym.
But, you know, but it's not often. It's not often.
What about sweet and sour chicken balls and fried rice every now and again?
No, I don't really like that.
So you're not missing a big, dirty, greasy...
No. And actually, I prefer now to eat healthy. Once the body changes, then the body wants different things.
When I said to you, when we met off air, I said, God, jeez, I actually did a double take because you look so well and so fit and, you know, like a man who's just got a handle on it all compared to, you know, I've met you, as I say, at different times. And like all of us, sometimes our hand isn't so strong on the tiller. Are you okay with people saying that to you? Gosh, John,
It's great.
Because it's commenting on people's size, weight, appearance generally is considered a little bit uncouth.
Yeah, I mean, no, actually, I like it when people do because it makes me feel that I have achieved what I set out to achieve. And I feel so much more confident in myself. You know, change my wardrobe and tell you, because I no longer have like a whole load of large shirts. I have small shirts.
Yeah.
I used to wear a lot of jumpers because it would be, you know, cover up everything. You know, everything. I when I go out, say, in an evening now, I like looking forward to what you've always been a clothes guy, you know, but you've always had the frame for it.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't. And now I do. And I really enjoy it. I just feel more confident in myself. My creativity is better. Everything in my life is better.
Everything's better.
Yeah, I just feel happier. So,
gosh, what a great lesson. Yeah. And it sounds to me, can I eat less, eat the good stuff,
exercise,
move more.
Yeah.
Like you're not taking pills. You didn't do an operation. You didn't go to Turkey.
No, it's not that complicated. You know, you know, I was saying earlier that there's a multi-million pound industry in diet books and so on and diet things. If you just eat healthy and exercise, you know, you may not lose tons and tons of it, but you will lose some and you will feel better about yourself. And that's what's more important. It's not about, it all comes down to mental health, really. That if you're confident in how you feel, you can still be bigger, but if you feel better about yourself, everything in your life is good. Your relationships are going to be better. Your work is going to be better. You'll probably live longer.
Yeah,
it's a good way to be.
You're selling it well.
Yeah.
The second book we've asked you to pick from the bookshelf, from your own personal bookshelf, John Boyne, today is The Life Changer. And do you believe that books can be powerful enough to change a reader's life?
Oh, I do. I do. And there's been plenty of them that have changed mine.
Was this a hard decision for you?
No.
To pick one?
Not really. This is probably really the one. It's The Cider House Rules by John Irving. You asked me earlier about, you know, when I started moving into more contemporary fiction and so on. So I guess when I was 16, 17, I bought The Cider House Rules. It was my first real, I guess, contemporary novel. Didn't know anything about it. Didn't know anything about John Irving. And
he's The World According to Gar.
The World According to Gar. Yeah. And subsequently, Prefero and Meany, Widow for 1 Year.
Yes.
So many books. And this book, I've always loved, again, this is about orphans. In fact, it begins in an orphanage. Dr. Larch and
amazing.
Homer Wells is the boy who lives at St. Cloud's.
We'll just pause there for a moment to all the psychologists listening this morning, our psychiatrists, if they'd like to get in touch and let us know what the hell's going on in John Boyne's head when it comes to orphanages. Yeah,
it's a bit odd, but I guess the reason I like orphans is because what I like is the idea of children being in charge of their own lives and destinies.
So what is this book about?
So this is about, it opens in an orphanage in Maine, with Dr. Larch. He runs this orphanage and he's a wonderful, kind man. And it's set just before the outbreak of the Second World War. But what we gradually, and he has a favorite orphan, Homer Wells is his favorite orphan. And we see the story, it's Homer Wells' story. We follow him through it. But what we gradually learn is that Dr. Larch is also an abortionist. So he takes in young women who have found themselves unhappily pregnant and performs abortions. And he has two nurses, Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna, who help him with this. And he's training up Homer eventually to take over the orphanage and to take over the abortion clinic. Mm-hmm. As Homer grows up, Homer decides he doesn't want to do that. That for various reasons that appear through the story, he decides that he doesn't want to be an abortionist. So it's and John Irving is somebody who campaigned a lot for abortion rights in the States. So it's very much coming from that perspective of women's rights, abortion rights. But he does a very good job in it of presenting both sides of that argument by having his narrator be somebody who, in fact, is not of his own mindset on this. But it's also, a Bildungsroman, the whole life story of one person from birth to death, which I love.
You love that epic.
I do. I love that epic storytelling. Yeah. And, you know, they say John Irving is kind of the contemporary Dickens. I mentioned Dickens.
Yes,
you know,
so I see where we're going here. Yeah.
So it's very much that kind of thing. And there's a David Copperfield in this book, you know, because Dr. Larch names some of the orphans after Dickens characters.
I can see why you like this book. All right.
But it's also, you know, when Homer leaves the orphanage, he goes off to the orchards of Maine, and it opens up into this wonderful story of there's these black characters who are working, who are being financially abused effectively in these orchards. Mm-hmm. And he is a very moral character, Homer, and he's very good. Because he's been brought up, well, Dr. Larch is a very moral character as well. And he's been brought up to be good and decent and kind. And he changes, you know, a lot of their lives. And it's just wonderful. It's just a wonderful piece of storytelling. And I've written two fan letters in my life.
Go on. Right?
The first was when I was 9 and I wrote a fan letter to the Kids from Fame and they did not write back to me. And I wrote to Carlo Imperato and
nothing.
Sent him, a fan letter age 9. I didn't even probably realize why I was obsessed with him.
Why is him, I wonder?
Well, what is it? What is it about him? What is it about this blonde-haired 18-year-old that is intriguing me so much?
It's a singing voice, I know it.
Yeah. He did have a nice singing voice.
Yeah,
he sung, which was Friday Night, that was his one.
Oh
Friday
my
night.
God, the detail.
Anyway, yeah, go on. I'm veering off
into... Fan letter number two.
Fan letter number two was 20 years later when I was 29, and I published my first novel, and I sent a copy of the novel with a fan letter to John Irving. And I sent him a letter saying, basically, you know, how much he had influenced me and how important he had been to me in my writing journey and how much I loved his books. And he, unlike Carlo Imperato from Fame, did write back to me. And you can see this picture. John was the poster boy for American literature back in the day.
He wrote back to you.
He wrote back to me and he read the book. And he told me how he really enjoyed the book and wished me well, and we struck up a correspondence which has continued over the last 23 years. We've become great friends.
Good
He's
Lord.
Become a mentor to me. We've met each other on many, many occasions. I've interviewed him on stage many times. He's interviewed me on stage at the Toronto Writers Festival.
Isn't that something?
I have two tattoos. One on my right arm, which is Wave After Wave, from my favorite singer, Kate Bush. This is from the Hands of Love album. And one on my left arm, which is We Are All Terminal Cases, which is the last line of The World According to Garp.
We Are All Terminal Cases is written in what looks like a type font.
Yeah, it's American typewriter font, which is very like the logo of your show here. Yeah, so.
Wave After Wave is from Kate Bush.
And this is in the font that Tennyson wrote Mort d'Arthur in, because that is reproduced on the back of the Hounds of Love album. And when Kate Bush had the concerts in London in 2014, all these little pieces of paper fell from the ceiling with that. So I took that and I used the exact thing. And
wow.
Shameless name dropping. Yeah. I had lunch with Kate only a few months ago and I got the opportunity to show it to her. And, you know, I was like, look.
I love an old name drop. So let's pick it up and put it on the table here. How did you end up having lunch with Kate Bush?
Well, Kate Bush, I've been obsessed with Kate Bush since I was a child. She's been my favorite singer. I've listened to her albums thousands upon thousands upon thousands of times. And I just adore her. And she's always seemed like a very mythical creature to me. In fact, when I went to the concert in 2014, it was shocking to me that she actually existed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But a few years ago, Faber and Faber published a collection of her song lyrics. And I wrote a piece about it for the Irish Times. And it was a review, but really it was an essay on these lyrics and how important they were. And then a few years later, when they were publishing it in paperback, they asked me, you know, could they use a quote from that on the back of the jacket? And I said, yeah. And then I thought to myself, look, this is as close as I'm ever going to get to Kate Bush. So actually, I wrote a third fan letter, as it turns out.
Come on.
So I sent a letter to, when the Faber people said this, I said, yeah, that's fine. But I included just a little note for Kate Bush saying, dear Kate Bush, you know,
the love is real.
Yeah. And I just said, you know, how much her music had been important to me and various songs and all this, and sent it and, you know, didn't expect to hear anything. And then a few months later, I was at home and I was upstairs where my piano is in the house, and I could hear, my phone was downstairs and I could hear my phone ringing, and I didn't bother going down, and it rung three or four times, and eventually I thought, I better go down, you know, in case it's something horrendous has happened. Yeah. I went down and it was a number I didn't recognize, and I thought, I'll ring this back and see what it is. And I rung it back and I was like, yeah, I've got like three missed calls from this, and
you're a weirdo.
Yeah, who is this? And who is this calling me? And this voice in the end said, you know, is this John Boyne? I went, yes. And she said, this is Kate Bush. And I was like, oh, okay. Hello. Hello, how are you? Sorry I didn't answer the phone the three times you called. Anyway, so we ended up having this big long conversation for an hour on the phone.
Wow.
And,
wow, really?
And then she said, oh, you know, if you're ever in, you know, Oxford or London or something, you should, you know, it would be nice to meet. Yeah. And immediately I was like, well, as it happens, yes, I will be in London. You know, randomly picked a date out of my head. But yeah, I'll be in London on, you know, in June or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so one thing led to another, and we ended up going out for lunch and a few drinks. And it was amazing. She was so kind and so thoughtful.
So you went to, where'd you go for lunch?
Did
you go
to? Just to a place near where
near
she
her?
Is. Yeah. And she was lovely. And, you know, we talked a lot about music, a lot about books. And she was, it was just very kind of her, I thought, you know, to spend time, because, you know, she is the kind of artist who has very obsessive fans. And I know, because I am one of them. So I thought for her to take the risk, perhaps, of meeting somebody who, you know, could possibly kidnap her and, you know, take her home to Dublin or, you know, keep her in the basement.
like the other ones.
Yeah, yeah. But it was amazing. And so I got the opportunity to show her this tattoo. But then the other tattoo, the We Are All Terminal Cases one. So I got this in Toronto one time. I was there and I was with John, and he's got quite a few tattoos, and he had got a new tattoo, which was the last line of another classic book, the last phrase of it being "Only found another orphan." Now, do you know what that is?
Again. Only found
another orphan.
No,
it's Moby Dick.
Oh,
so it's the last line of that. And he had just got that. And then I was going down to the States I was on a book tour, but I was coming back up to Toronto for something. And we were meeting up again. And in the meantime, I decided I would get the last line of Garp on mine. And so I showed it to him and he was like, oh, well, he said, it's not a very sad line. And I thought, no, because it's actually very seize the day. You know, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
So he just really thought, he said, you know, that's some excellent sucking up as well.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You got this on your arm.
And I noticed that, like, as tattoos go, a lot of people tend to, I don't have any, but but a lot of people put them under their arm. Yours is very much linear.
The Kate
one
is under, and the John one is over. When I did the Kate one, it's very sore getting it done, because the skin underneath your arm is much more tender than the skin at the front of your arm.
Yes.
So I didn't have really any great thought process behind it, other than when I got the second one, I didn't want to go through that pain again. So I put it on the front.
Your copy of John Irving, you do something that my dad bequeathed to me, which is a habit of putting your name and the date of, I presume, when you read the book or bought it first, in the with your pen signed at the top right-hand corner of the...
I actually don't do that anymore.
Do you
But
not?
I used to do it. And
I don't do it as much, but it's a thing. John M. Boyne.
Well, I think, you know, again, I was being pretentious and young. I was a teenager. And I think when the first stories I put... The first stories I published, actually, were... I don't even want to say it.
Let's hear it, John.
It was originally Johnny. Because when I was in UEA, all the students called me Johnny.
In the University of East Anglia.
Yeah. So the stories I published, and all the people I still know from there still call me Johnny when they see me. So the stories I published while I was there and in the anthology were all that. And then when I started getting published, I just went as John.
Hurtful and annoying was it for John M. Boyne, self-named, to be called Johnny then? And he was like, did that kind of...
No, I kind of liked it.
Did you?
And I don't really know how it started, but it just seemed to be...
You were happy to roll.
There was
that.
Another John in the class, and maybe that was how, but I kind of liked it.
Cider House Rules, I'm thinking Michael Caine played the lead role in the
film.
Yes,
he did, and he won an Oscar.
And he won an Oscar for it. Okay, so in what way did this book change your life?
By showing me the possibilities of contemporary fiction.
Oh, so it was a writing life changer. Yes,
yeah,
it wasn't.
But also introducing me to the my favourite writer. My favorite contemporary writer, bringing somebody into my life who became a great mentor, a great friend.
Yeah, it is life changing.
So that's the
third and final book that we ask you to pick today, John Boyne, is the book that made you cry. And before we look at this, what looks like a beautifully well-read copy of a book, which I have not heard of, I'll be honest with you, ever, which makes it even more intriguing for me to hear the reasons for it. But first, before we get to that, is are you a crier? Do you shed tears?
In real life,
real life, do you?
In books, very rarely.
Yeah, isn't it funny?
I think the two hardest things for a writer to do is to make somebody laugh and to make somebody cry. I think scary, you can make them scared, you know, but making somebody cry or making them laugh is very, very difficult.
So what makes you cry in life?
Like, I'm very emotional in life. Anything, you know, like a traffic jam. Yeah. you know, I would be very emotional with friends and family. I'm just an emotional person.
You're happy to express yourself, be it through tears or what have you.
And I think tears can be good. You know, a good cry is often needed. And movies make me cry more than books do, actually.
Yeah. So acting can move you or scripting or what have you. And that brings us neatly to the book that made you cry. Tell us about it.
Well, this is The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley. And it's not just the book that made me cry, but it's also my favourite novel of all time.
Right.
So I do recommend it to you since you haven't read it. And
thank you.
It's the book I give people the most as well for that very reason. And it's the most beautiful but tragic love story in its way. It's about this little boy who...
an orphan by any chance, is he?
He is basically, he's effectively an orphan. He goes to he's poor, and he goes to his rich friend's house for the summer, set in the start of the 1910s or so.
Oh yeah.
He goes to his rich friend's house for the summer. He's only about 12 years old. And he falls in love with the older sister of his friend, Marion Maudsley, who's about 18. And it's his first experience of feeling those emotions, first of falling in love. And what happens is she uses him as a go-between. She is sending letters to the farmer who lives next door, with whom she is having a romance. He thinks that she is falling for him, even though he's only 12. He thinks she's falling for him. And a moment comes in the book where he discovers them together, and it shatters him.
The heartache.
Yeah. And he tells this story though from when he's old, when he's very old, and he's looking back at this one moment in his life that shattered his life and made his life almost romantically impossible. And you've read quite a number of my books, and I've often used that conceit, an old person looking back at life where one moment, you know, in the absolutist, one moment in life has affected
changes
the entire
everything. Yeah.
Life. You know, all the broken places, Gretel looks back at this one experience. I've done it in quite a few, but it's so sad and so tragic, and he just never gets over it. And it also tells us that, you know, something traumatic that can happen to you when you're a child can affect the rest of your life badly. There's not any laughs in this one. This is a guy who is, you know, telling this story from old age and reconciling the sorrow of this moment with the fact that his life, he never found love. He never was ever able to build relationships. So it's very sad.
What do you think made you cry reading this book?
The realization that can happen. I do believe, like, I think childhood is the most important time in life. That an unhappy childhood does not have to make for an unhappy adulthood, but there's more chances of an unhappy adulthood if you've had an unhappy childhood. The most important thing anybody can do in life, I think, is to be a good parent, bring up your children happily. You know, my parents did that. They brought us up happily. But literature is different. In literature, we kind of want to read about trauma a lot. We want to read about real, like, heartache and to experience that in some way and to feel some connection with characters. So I feel his pain. I didn't go through that at 12 years old or something, but I just feel the pain of that character and the pain of something that can happen to a childhood that affects your ability to form relationships.
Is that an echo of your story there? I mean,
I suppose it is.
Not to press it, but I mean...
I suppose it is, but, you know, but things are better for me on that score now. You know, I'm pretty okay on that. But
that book just resonated.
It does. And the best ones do. You know, when I was thinking about the answers to these questions for today, you know, looking around the books on my shelves, books like the Robin Hood, Sidehouse Rules, Go Between, these are the books that have resonated with me. Secret History is a book that resonated
with me. Donna Tartt, yeah.
More recently, The Beasting by Paul Murray is a book that I think will resonate with me for the rest of my life. The Slap by Christos Tsolkas is probably my favorite book of this century.
Well, and again, it of this century.
Yeah, of the 21st century, that's the one that I would choose.
Again, that's that, and me and McEwan does this very well, that where everything was going along fine and then... whether that's The Slap or it's The Kiss That Shouldn't Have Been or The Kiss That Was Refused or whatever it might be, everything changes on that coin. That's what you, and then you write that beautifully.
But also, like, we're both readers. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I read about maybe 80 books a year, right? And of those 80 books, chances are 75 of them won't remain with me, But every time I open a book to start reading it, I want it to be one of these. I want it to be one of these books that I will eventually be talking about and proselytizing and giving to people. But they're few and far between.
Who's L.P. Hartley?
He wrote quite a lot of books. Simonetta Perkins is another book of his. Eustace and Hilda was a book of his that was used on the Leaving... do you remember The Shrimp and the Anemone that was used around that time on the Leaving Cert? Remember there was like a modern novel thing, right. I think, where there was like 10 books and you could choose
pick one of them from the list. Yeah,
Old Man and the Sea and
Yes.
So he's not really very well known these days, but he'd be best known for this. This also has the most famous, I think, one of the most famous opening lines.
Please give it to us.
The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there.
Oh, very good. I didn't know that was his expression. Yeah. Wow.
And this was made into a movie in the early 70s with Julie Christie and Alan Bates, which was a very successful movie at the time. So it's not very well known these days, and L.P. Hartley certainly is not very well known and is due a revival.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought this book and him into our lives today, because that's the joy of reading is the joy of discovery.
Yeah.
New books, and to hear you say that. The book is very sad, right?
Yes.
And it's not, is it grim in that sense? It's just sad, it's just
not
life.
Not grim, sad. It's, yeah, so it's moving.
Is it the saddest book you've ever read? In some ways.
Probably it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why do you give that as gifts to people?
Because it's also my favorite novel. And you know, it, like the
I
question,
just think I'd be really sad to read this now. I want to, but I don't want to.
It'll move you.
Yeah. I've done a fair bit of moving now. But I will definitely, that's going on my list.
If you find yourself on planes a lot, this is one to take with you.
John, the last question we ask, our last question is, could you please give us the name of the autobiography you haven't written yet? And before you do so, maybe give us a sense of where you are at in the world of autobiography. There's probably a lot of you in the books you've written thinly disguised or heavily disguised, either way.
In the latter books. Certainly.
In the latter books. Yeah. So how do you feel about autobiography or biography or, you know, autobiographying in your books, that sort of thing?
Well, I like doing it in the books, certainly, and I only really started doing that around the time of History of Loneliness, which was 2014. Before that, everything was very kind of made up, and then I became much more personal, maybe with confidence as a writer. But about 5-6 years ago, what I started doing was I keep a file on my computer of, I guess, what will eventually be an autobiography, in that, you know, I've written a lot about stuff that happened as a kid, but I've also written a lot about things that have happened to me since I became a writer. And it's no holds barred. I literally put all the scandals, all the dramas, everything down, When I eventually publish it, I'll have to start editing it, you know. But
you've just made a whole heap of people listening very nervous.
Yes, I know. But I just put them all down, and I figure, you know, eventually one day, unless I die, and if I die, well, it's not going to matter, because then they can publish it and it's not
be
gonna,
damned.
Yeah, publish and be damned. But like in any industry, there is endless dramas in the writing world, especially in the Irish writing world. It's just endless. It's too much sometimes. But anyway, so I keep it all written down, all the little gossip and all the scandals. And I, you know, I've got at least 150,000 words of it at this point. So I just keep adding to it. But I do have a title for it, which I came up with about a year or two ago.
Now, this isn't your autobiography, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, you are talking about yours. Okay, so it'll include all of that gossipy stuff, which we're all excited about, and then your own life.
Yeah, it'll all be in one thing.
Yeah. And you came up with the title a few years ago.
A couple of years ago.
Why?
Well, I heard this phrase and I thought, this is the best title. This would be the best title ever for an autobiography. And it was, remember when everything was happening with Harry and Meghan?
Yeah, right? Of course.
And the Queen issued that statement and she said, recollections may vary.
Oh, very good.
And I thought,
that's a classy.
Recollections may vary.
So you're quoting Queen Elizabeth II, late... Queen of...
Because it would be my take on the things that happened, but recollections may vary. I just thought it was the greatest line I'd ever heard.
You know? It is such a good line. It covers everything.
Yeah. So hopefully nobody will steal it between now and then. But,
no, you nearly need to put a copyright on that. Why haven't you written an autobiography yet?
Well, no, I mean, why haven't I published it? Because I just want to keep it going until I'm about 80.
And, so you think that's the age?
Yeah, I think it'd be a bit... I'm only 52. I think it would be a bit young. But, you know, and I've had my, as you know, because we've talked about them on air, I've had my own share of little dramas and things. Yeah. And, you know, I want to kind of put all the real stories of those. And I think, you know, when you're 80 and you publish it, it's like, you know, you've nothing to lose.
Yeah, but you dangled this big carrot in front of us now. Why wait till 80?
Well, maybe a little earlier.
I think you should
Tone it down a bit. But, you know, it would be too... It'd be too scandalous to publish right now.
Wow! Now I definitely want to read. The only thing is, if you feel it's that dangerous, of course, it just becomes a bumper novel that is just heavily, heavily, heavily disguised, and everyone will be reading it to see are we in it. And
The contents or the index at the back, you know, that would be the first thing. But we'll see one day.
Look forward to reading that, John Boyne. Quartet of books is kind of on the go. Already, we've had Water, which I really loved, and. Then we're going to be looking at
Earth the second, and then Fire in November, and Air the following May. So it's every 6 months.
That was an interesting mode of writing, four elements.
And four short books. You know, I've written a lot of long books.
Yeah.
And, you know, Hearts Invisible Furies is actually 2,000 words longer than Moby Dick.
Is it really?
Yes, which I always kind of pleased by.
Yeah, no, but, yeah, but
it's 203,000, and Moby Dick is 201. Yeah. But these four books are only 40,000, so they're quite short. And I wanted to write four short books in this way, where really, you know, like a sponge that you're wringing out, get every drop of, you know, no fat, no water, you know, just no fat on the bones, exactly. And four separate stories, all centered around a similar theme, but standalone. So a minor character from each becomes the narrator of the next.
Yeah.
And I've pretty much finished all four now. So it's been an exciting project. I'd say the hardest part was, you know, at the start of number three, which is the most difficult in terms of the subject, but also I was still so far away from finishing all four that I was like, oh, you know,
Will it ever end?
This was a lot to take on, but I'm glad I did. I think it's a good project.
You are without question one of my favorite Irish living authors. I just gobble up your books when they come out. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
This is good, yeah.
Because
I think I've humiliated myself in many ways.
So. And therefore, mission accomplished on my
exactly.
part.
Well done.
No, but I really enjoyed seeing you in such good form, with such an interesting and thought out trilogy of books that you have, and a cracking autobiography that's bubbling under the surface. John, good to see you.
Thanks a lot, you too.
So here's this week's Ryan Recommends, brought to you by Easton, Ireland's favourite bookseller. I'm going with Strange Sally Diamond by Liz Nugent, one of my favourite Irish writers. She started her writing career with Unravelling Oliver, but she's come a long way now with Strange Sally Diamond. I could tell you all about the book, couldn't I? And I normally would at this point. But what I'm going to do is, I'm going to put my glasses on. I'm going to go to the first line of the first chapter. I'm going to read this line, and then you can decide whether you like the sound of it or not. It goes like this. Put me out with the bins, he said regularly. When I die, put me out with the bins. I'll be dead, so I won't know any different. You'd be crying your eyes out, and he would laugh, and I'd laugh too, because we both knew that I wouldn't be crying my eyes out. I never cry. That's Sally Diamond talking about her father, who wanted to be put out with the bins when he died. And so begins this peculiar but brilliantly written, quite dark thriller by Liz Nugent. I think you'll really like it. This book and all the books we discuss on this episode of our podcast are available now in your local Easton store, or order them online from eastons.com before 6 p.m. for same day dispatch, and they will deliver for free when you spend over a tenner. Easton, be inspired.